Welcome to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Amos. Nice to
Thanks
hear
for joining
you this
me.
Morning. Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, let's start with a question from Pat Russell. Is there a, quote, first question or questions that should be asked before asking, is there a God? If so, what do you think that question is?
Yeah, I've never thought about this before, but I think the question, is there a God, is an entirely appropriate question right out of the chute. I don't see anything untoward about it, unfair or unreasonable. I think our native intuitions are that there is a God. Okay, this is in Scripture clearly in Romans chapter 1, 18 and following. It's not only apparent outside of us, but inside of us, the way Paul describes it. This is why the vast majority of the people, I mean like 95, 98% of the people in the world, believe in a supernatural realm with a divine being of some sort that operates within that realm. That is the natural inclination, and I think the natural inclination is for those two reasons. People have, as Calvin put it, the sensus divinitatus, the sense of the divine inside, and Paul says God made it evident within them in Romans 1, and there is this evidence outside, the grandeur, we are so taken with everything. And by the way, this is evidenced by the fact that even atheists talk about Mother Nature. Now, I know they could say, oh, that's just the way we talk, but you talk that way for a reason. We naturally invoke a person because it looks like a person has been involved, which Richard Dawkins acknowledges in the opening paragraph of his famous Blind Watchmaker. The biological realm is a complex realm that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, he denies that the appearances reflect reality. He thinks it's just an appearance and it's not design, and he gives his arguments. But notice the impulse. He's got to acknowledge what is obvious. So I think most people have this sense. So if people are denying or questioning whether God exists or not, it's for some reason. That is, I don't think this is the question that people ask out of the chute with nothing else happening. Gee, never occurred to me. Maybe there are leprechauns. It didn't really come up on my radar. You know, I never had reason to think that. I certainly never assumed it, but it's kind of an open question. No, they don't do that. But they do that with God. Why? Because is there a God? Because something has happened to make them distrust the existence of God or question the existence of God. And here, I think what they're doing is they're questioning their native intuitions, their native natural understandings about the nature of the world. Someone made this. It didn't make itself. And there's evidence of design all around us. And so, therefore, implicitly, we're acknowledging a God, and 99% of the people in the world are trying to figure out what that God looks like or what that dimension is like. And it's only when something negative comes up, tragedy or whatever, or some kind of conflict or an intervention in personal desires, you know, your God doesn't want me to do that, what I want to do. Well, I don't believe in your God. But what's going on there is self-interest, not a clear-headed rejection of the existence of God. I was so amazed, you know, when Bertrand Russell, the great 20th century atheistic British philosopher, said, I don't believe in God because there's no evidence. There's not enough evidence. And what he said is he concluded, like Richard Dawkins does, nothing of blind indifference, you know. He said he's nihilistic. But a nihilism isn't the obvious truth about the world. Most people aren't naturally, there's no meaning of any kind, you know. And so this doesn't make any sense to me. By the way, this reminds me, to go back to that quote about Richard Dawkins. Dawkins says that this is the kind of world that you'd expect if there was no God. There is no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, wait a minute. Why would anybody conclude those things that he says are obvious about the world and therefore indicate? It's certainly not obvious to me that there's no evil and no good. Even Richard Dawkins talks in moralistic terms when he condemns the God of the Bible, and he's using those terms in an objectivistic way. He's not saying, I just don't like that. No, he's saying this God is bad, therefore your God is not good if he exists. That's his argument. No purpose? Why would somebody say there's no purpose? See, what Dawkins has done is his atheism requires no evil, no good, no purpose, no design. And so given that he's the atheist, he asserts that the universe looks that way, when in fact this is not the way the universe looks at all. It does seem to have teleology. That's the design argument. It does seem to have morality. That's the moral argument, and evidence, by the way, for the problem of evil. If there's a problem of evil, then there's objective morality, okay? It does seem to have a creator, an explanation for its existence that's outside of the natural realm. That's the cosmological argument. So my sense is that when I don't mind people asking the question right off, but I suspect that there's always something else going on that would cause them to raise the question, because the answer in the affirmative is the most natural and obvious. Doesn't mean that our understanding of God is correct. That may be an open question at this point. But it does mean that people have a sense of transcendence, which is why they talk about it all the time. They have a sense of ultimate meaning and value. They have a sense of right and wrong, moral motions, as Francis Schaeffer put it. This is universal among humankind. People are always asking the question, what's it all about? That is evidence that there is purpose in the universe, that we ask that question about the purpose of the universe. If there was no purpose and we were not seekers of purpose by nature, the answer, then we wouldn't even be asking the question. We would be going around like the rest of the animals, you know, living completely in the moment and not planning for the future in a thoughtful fashion. Even ants don't plan for the future. They just do what they're programmed to do. They store stuff up, you know. But, you know, it's not – human beings have access to a whole range of different things animals don't, because of the unique abilities that they have to see things that are there that are not physical. Mm-hmm. So I think the default position is God for good reason. And when people say, well, why should I believe there is a God? It's because something has gone on in their life that has caused them to question their native intuitions about reality.
The only questions I could possibly think that might come before, I don't know that I would say that there are things that should be asked. There are things that could be asked. For example, do I exist? That's one question. And then the second question would be,
who's asking the question? That would be the – when somebody says, do I exist? Well, who's asking the question, you know, as one person then, famously put it.
Yes. But this, and the second one would be, is it possible for me to comprehend reality? I think those are the only two questions that could come before that. But there are things that we assume as we do everything. We assume that we can comprehend reality in some way.
Yes, of course. Even the question entails a certain comprehension of reality. You have to be able to perceive on a certain level and organize thoughts in a certain way about reality to be able to ask further questions about it. Okay, so you got a machine that's broken. Well, how can you comprehend how this machine works? Well, the question that occurs to your mind forces you to look more carefully about the thing to see how this thing goes together and how it may not be working. I mean, it's a kind of a odd illustration, but I think all of these evidence the fact that the things that are in question are actually going on inside the person when they ask the question, or else the question would never come up. People say, where's the evidence of purpose in the universe? That we are looking for purpose is an evidence of purpose. We are purpose-seeking creatures. How does that happen? We are given, we have the faculty to find something. And so that if there were no purposes, there would be no faculty for that, it seems to me. Why do humans ask this kind of question? There certainly is no survival benefit to that if you want to opt for the evolutionary answer. Animals don't seem to ask this question. So, but they have survived fine, you know, for all this time, however long it's been.
All right, let's take a question from Jeff. Since Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, doesn't that mean they were amoral beings before eating? Although what they did was wrong, she couldn't have known that until she did it, since morally wrong wasn't a concept to her. No wonder she was terrified.
No, that's a fair question, but I think there's a good answer. It's somewhat speculative because we're not given the details there. There are different types of knowledge, okay? There's knowledge that, so there's factual knowledge. There is know-how, okay? I know how to change my tire or change the oil in my car or something, which I don't know how to do, but I'm just saying. And there's also knowledge by acquaintance, so I know you, okay? So those are three different kinds of knowledge. And if people take the statement in Genesis chapter 2, that warning, as being knowledge of fact or information, well, then it does seem odd. How can you be held responsible for something that you have no comprehension to understand? By the way, I think there's an answer to that. You can have a comprehension of understanding it even though you don't do it. Okay? I think that what happened with Adam and Eve is they understood that they ought to obey their sovereign and they ought not disobey. So those are the moral categories that are already in place, all right? What they didn't have is any experience of evil. So after the fall, what does it say about Adam's relationship with Eve? It says he knew her and they conceived a son, for example. So the concept of knowledge in that case is an intimate experience of the other person, that being, in that case, a sexual experience that produced offspring. Okay? So there's a distinction then between knowing in the abstract, as knowing that, and having experiential knowledge of the thing. And I suspect, and it's speculation, but I suspect that's what's going on there. They had the ability to comprehend what they should do and shouldn't do in light of the command of the sovereign. It's built into our natures. We are moral creatures, all right? What they did not have, they were innocent. They had no experience of evil until they disobeyed. And then they knew evil experientially. Now, the little hitch in my explanation, it says there that they will be like God, knowing good and evil. Now, God doesn't experience evil personally, okay? But he has an external experience of evil. The angels have already fallen, okay? So where Adam and Eve were completely morally innocent. They had not done any evil, nor had they encountered evil, all right? So when they sin, though, they do evil, and that's an encounter of evil. And then so on a number of levels, they're experiencing evil. And so they are like God in the sense that they are encountering evil and knowing evil and its tangibility in life and its destructive force. In this case, it's destructive to them, though, where in God's case, it wasn't destructive to him. I think that's a way of making sense of that statement that's consistent with good theology. But, you know, anybody's point of view on that one's going to be somewhat speculative because we don't have an explanation. But it need not be simply a knowledge, a factual knowledge, a ability to comprehend culpability, right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, she clearly knew that she wasn't supposed to do it. She says that much to the serpent. So she right. was aware of the concept that God had said, do not do this, mm-hmm. that she wasn't supposed to do it, because they already had the capacity for moral thinking and moral actions.
Right.
And of course, just because she hadn't sinned, that doesn't mean she didn't have the capacity for moral actions, or else that would say God was amoral because he's never sinned.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Hopefully that will help you, Jeff. All right. Let's go on to one more question. This one comes from C4 The Truth. Thoughts on the spiritual gift of prophecy. Does the prophetic office still exist? And if so, in what form? If one of the prophecies is incorrect, for example, COVID will disappear by such and such a date, does that disqualify and or discredit the prophet? Is the New Testament standard different than the Old Testament?
Well, let me take it in reverse, that there are some very fine people, Wayne Grudem, for example, that thinks that the New Testament standard is different because it says in 1 Thess 5, do not despise prophetic utterance, but examine everything carefully. And so this means to sift. Well, the way he takes it is to sift through and find out what is true in the prophetic utterance and what isn't. I think this is J.P. Moreland's view as well. The claim is that there is an inaccurate prophetic word that's given, I think, by Agabus, and he says that when you go, when you go to Jerusalem, you are going to be bound and taken away captive by the Jews. Well, that didn't happen. They were bound and taken. He was bound and taken captive by the Romans. So they got it kind of. Agabus got it kind of right, but he made a mistake. Now, my response to that is, I don't agree with either of those points. Okay, to say that we examine everything carefully does not necessarily mean to sift through and find out what parts of the prophecy are accurate and what aren't. How would we be able to do that if we don't have the prophetic insight ourselves? You know, of course, you can always wait to see if the prophetic word foretold something that was going to happen and it didn't happen that way, or at least then you'd know, well, part of it. But this is completely useless to us then, because notice the power of prophetic gifts is that the author of the words is God. This is why it can be trusted and why the Old Testament standard is all the words have to be accurate, because God can't make a mistake of God speaking through a person. He is not limited by the person. God is the one who secures the legitimacy and accuracy of any prophetic word. And if that's not the case, then you can't trust anything in the Bible, because human beings wrote the Bible. And unless God is the one who ensures that they wrote down exactly what they want, we can't trust it. If we're going to say, well, you know, they got some right and they got some wrong, if that's our standard for revelation, well, then how do we know what's right and what's wrong? We don't. We have no means whatsoever to assess that, okay? And that's why the doctrine for inspiration is that the words themselves are God's words. God breathed, 2 Timothy 3. And so we don't limit God in our doctrine of inspiration by the limitations of the writers. Yet this is precisely what happens when there's another prophetic word from a prophet that people are doing now. In the New Testament, well, you know, people can get it wrong. Well, they could just get it wrong in the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. And so how does that help anything? And as for Agabus getting it wrong, Agabus did not get it wrong. Okay? When Peter gave his sermon on a Pentecost, he spoke to the Jews and he said, this Jesus who you crucified, God has made him both Lord and Christ. They didn't crucify anybody. The Romans crucified him. But what Peter was pointing out was the original source of the action. The Romans did the dirty work, but if it had not been for the Jews' actions to bring him before Pilate and to persuade Pilate, then Jesus would not have been crucified. Pilate didn't want to crucify him. So Peter is holding the Jews responsible for what they did, even though they didn't put the nails in Jesus' hands. And that's precisely what happened with Agabus. It was the Jews that fomented the difficulty that got Peter arrested. I'm sorry, Paul arrested, and that the circumstances that resulted in Paul appealing to Caesar and heading off to Rome. So Agabus was perfectly accurate. He wasn't half and half. Okay, so there's nothing in the New Testament to justify taking prophecy differently than the Old Testament and the Old Testament standard, Deuteronomy 18 or somewhere thereabouts, pardon me, is perfection for the reason that I just gave you. If it's God's words, then God's not going to make a mistake. And if prophets did not prophesy accurately, they were put to death, or supposed to be. So they had to sign their testimony in blood. So there's not a single reason why something magical happened at 0 BC that changed all the rules about prophecy. I don't understand that. And if it did, this leaves all kinds of chaos open in the church, which is what we have. All these people practicing prophecy. You don't practice prophecy. It's a revelatory gift, just like you don't practice writing Bible verses, creating your own revelation Bible verses. The disciples didn't practice for a while until they get it right. It was God responsible for that. So anyway, that's an answer to this, to the second half of the question. The first half, though, is very simple. I have no good reason to think that prophetic gifts are no longer active today. I have no good theological reason. Now, I was in a charismatic environment for the first 30 years of my Christian life. And to be honest with you, lots of people said, thus saith the Lord, but I don't know I ever heard the real McCoy. I think there's a lot of nonsense and maybe well-meaning nonsense, but nothing from God in that sense that's being uttered by people who say, well, the Lord says, I got a word for you, this, that, and the other thing. I think that flows like water off people's lips now. And they have a frivolous attitude towards God's word. When God spoke, it was rare. Not only in the Old Testament, but also in the book of Acts. Rare. And so I think that certainly God can do that. And I think the standards are still the same. I know that there are prophets who told Nabil Qureshi he was going to live. He didn't. He died. They should be silent forever, because they cannot be trusted to tell the truth from God in a prophetic fashion. They can actually pass scripture fine, but they should stay away from saying, thus saith the Lord, mm-hmm. because they have been demonstrated to be false in their pronouncements.
We would be better off if everyone took that much more seriously. Mm-hmm. The idea that you mentioned that the prophets in the Old Testament sealed those prophecies with their blood.
That's right.
They were taking their lives into their hands. And I think if we should be taking it that seriously and not just saying things we feel or that comes to mind and saying it's from God.
Even if we really, 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 really believe it. Believe it, are you going to believe it enough to put your life on the line for it?
But I agree with you, too. I don't think that it's not ever happening. I think it probably does happen. But there can be incidents
of prophecy, even though an individual is not a prophet. I think that that can happen, but I think those things are rare, you know. And I'm not even like the Spirit can come upon someone. Well, that's an Old Testament motif. But a person can be filled with the Spirit and then speak something for God. But even though he doesn't have this role of speaking out the utterances of God. I do not think that there are authoritative prophets in the New Testament time, though, just like apostles. and this is a real problem with the new apostolic reformation and people who are speaking not just in terms of giving a word from God, but they operate in the office of the prophet to guide the people of God. That is an Old Testament motif. We are not in that motif now. Mm-hmm. It is a different motif. So in that sense, I think there's good reason to believe that they are the foundation, having built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Ephesians 2, and then built stone by stone on top of it. So in Ephesians 4, you know, when it talks about the apostles and prophets, etc., gifted men of the church, it's talking there about the foundation, not about every generation of people in every church has apostles and prophets. Those people cause all kinds of problems, and they're doing it now.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, everyone, for your questions. We could not do the show without you, so we're really grateful that you have been part of our show by sending in your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.